extent of consultation. In the sense of our experts in law and experts in content, and the AG's office if necessary. And from next week, we will get into the deliberation. So we scheduled legal 45 minutes to do your presentation. Cody, 15 minutes to do your presentation, then we open up for discussion. Hopefully at the end of the day, honorable members will be able to give instructions to the drafters to go and do some work for us. If we are unable to do that today, we'll have to come back on Friday and do more. Because unless they draft over the festive, over the Easter recess, we're in trouble this year. So that's a decision we're going to have to take. I thought that we could finish it today, quite honestly, but I'm saying in the event that we don't, and we want to pass it this year, then it means you'll have to come and have a second stab at it on Friday. So that when we leave at the end of the term, they can do some work for 2 weeks, and then we come back and we look at it and consider their drafting and take it to the House. So that's really the proposal that we have, that we meet on Friday. If you are able to make it today, I'm not sure. I'd ask them to do a follow-up on the quorum. If we do meet on Friday, I'm not sure if she's got a response, but my plea is to do as much as possible today. I really don't think we need more than today to do it. But if we do, then we will not rush it. Happiness with that approach? Yes,
Mr. Chair,
I think
I've already submitted my apologies for Friday. I still have coffee.
No issue. All right, we'll see what happens at the end of the day today. Over to you. Any apologies? We have McLaughlin, Winter, Fanza, Lamini Jubazana, Mighty Light. Okay. All right. Those are the apologies that we have. And I'm sure they accept that there's not much we can do. Can we hand it over to our colleagues at Legal? And hopefully Legal round about 1:45 or so. Hopefully you'll be done with your presentation. Corley, you'll take over immediately thereafter, and then we'll have about 2 hours deliberation. Over to you, ma'am.
Good morning, Chair, honorable members and colleagues. Sorry, my mic is a little bit wonky here. Chair, what we've done is we've captured all the legal issues in a number of themes. So instead of doing a clause by clause at this stage, whilst we're still developing the policy and finalising the policy, we thought it would be easier to do it this way. I used a number of abbreviations throughout the document. They appear on page 1 in full. So I'll start with point 2, the constitutional mandate. And you'll recall that a number of the submitters challenged the constitutional validity of empowering the AG to issue the certificate of debt and to collect this debt. And I still refer throughout the document to debt collection, because even though the AG, we are in agreement that the AG himself will not collect the debt, there's still an element of debt collection insofar as the AG is now directing another state institution to collect that money. So the debt recovery aspect is still pertinent to the discussion. 3 arguments were presented in terms of which it was challenged that this mandate will not be constitutionally sound. The first is that the AG is not empowered in terms of the Constitution to issue such certificates or collect debt. So there's nothing specifically in the Constitution that directs that the AG may do this. In contrast to, for example, the public protector, where it says the public protector may issue remedial action. Secondly, it was argued that debt collection and the issuing of a certificate can't be considered to be part and parcel of the auditing aspect, which is what the AG must do. So it's too divorced from auditing, in other words. And then lastly, by empowering the AG to do this, would lead to the AG encroaching on the powers and functions of other organs of state, thereby threatening independence. And you will know that the way the Constitution, the architecture of the Constitution is that it does protect the independence of each institution, and particular local government was very concerned about this. On a careful reading of section 188, subsection 4, you will see that it uses the words additional powers and functions. And if I give this its ordinary meaning, to me it points to an intention to empower the AG to do more than what 188 already provides for. The intention, in our view, could not have been to provide for the enactment of legislation to merely regulate auditing and the reporting, which is already listed now as powers. If that were the case, then the word additional would not have been used. Rather, I think that what it would have read was that national legislation must be enacted to give effect to the manner in which the AG's powers and functions in 188.1-3 are regulated. So it would have been very specific. The way it's currently drafted is open-ended, and this view is supported by looking at the way other provisions in the Constitution are drafted. You'll see that there are numerous constitutional provisions that speak very directly to what national legislation must provide for. This one, as I said, is open-ended. Notwithstanding that, the second argument that it isn't linked, that these additional powers are not linked, we don't support that. In my view, they can be rationally connected to the primary function of the AG. We've considered international law, and in particular, we've looked at the Lima Declaration of 1977, which is adopted by the International Organization of Supreme Audit Institutions. This document considers the Magna Carta of public auditing standards, and whilst it doesn't speak particularly to this debt recovery collection, it does state to the extent the findings of the Supreme Audit Institution are not delivered as legally valid and enforceable judgments, the Supreme Audit Institution shall be empowered to approach the authority which is responsible for taking the necessary measures and require the accountable party to accept the responsibility. And I think this additional powers and functions fit quite neatly into that. As I said, there are plenty of international examples. I urge members to go and do a bit of research on Sri Lanka in particular, because they're battling with this very issue at the moment. Their public audit bill has not been passed precisely because there is opposing views as to whether this power should be included or not included. So Sri Lanka is battling with a very, very same issue that we're looking at currently. In our view, the recovery of funds is directly linked to audit findings and gives effect to the findings, which may otherwise be rendered meaningless by non-action. In this regard, the additional powers promote the objectives of transparency and accountability, which are founding features of our Constitution. The provision for additional powers and functions, the way in which it's crafted in subsection 4 is not unique to the AG, but it appears in all of the Chapter 9 bodies, and the provision was the subject of consideration in relation to the public protector in the so-called Nkandla judgment. But I just want to pause there. The difference between the provision on the AG and the provision of the public protector is that there it dealt with remedial action specifically. Nonetheless, the court does comment on the fact that the Public Protector Act gives the Public Protector various other powers and functions, and these included the power of referral, the power to bring to the attention of the prosecuting authority what appears to be an offence, the power to mediate, conciliate and negotiate, and to give advice. So these were all, the court found all of these to be additional to what the powers and functions were in that section dealing with the Public Protector. So if I use that as a basis, I cannot see how the constitutionality of this would be challenged. It's no different in my view. There is a rational connection. We further hold no legal objection to the AG being the responsible person for the actual debt collection function. However, having regard to the resource and capacity constraints of the AG, we agree that the option is not feasible at present. In the respect of the encouragement argument, we are in agreement that the AG can never usurp the powers and functions of another organ of state. Therefore, this power to issue a certificate and to recover funds cannot be done in a manner that impedes the independence or prevents an organ of state from following its own lawful prescripts. So there can be no stepping in the shoes of another functionary. There can be no parallel processes. The divine must provide ample opportunity for the accounting officer to do what the accounting officers mean to do in terms of law. In this way, the objective is for it to be a deterrence and an additional line of final defense rather than an arrogation of functions and powers. So when drafting and finalizing the draft, we'll ensure that that comes across more strongly in this version. Okay, point three, accounting officer and accounting authority. The definition, they included former persons who held such posts. Concerns were raised that the use of the word former in the definition would have the effect of making the bill retrospective. The policy intent was never to have retrospective effect, and the AG is in agreement with that. The inclusion of former accounting officer is limited in the recovery process to only hold to account those AOs or members of an accounting authority who have failed to act in terms of an audit report that's issued after the bill has come into operation. So by its nature, the function of auditing is backward looking. You don't audit for the future. So what would happen in practice if the bill comes into operation in 2018 and the AG then issues the audit report for the 2017-2018 financial year, which audit report is obviously including transactions prior to the bill coming into law, we would still be able to act against an AG there. But the AG will be given the full advantage of the 12 months as proposed by the AG. So there can be no retrospective effect because it's not on day one that the AG is going to come in and say that my audit report from a previous year had recommendations which you haven't carried out. So we are very confident that there is no retrospectivity. The second problem with the definition was the question as to why we are targeting the accounting officer, and that had to do with the definition of debtor in particular. Why the accounting officer or accounting authority rather than particular officials? Why have we chosen to act against this one functionary rather than the person that may have been the cause of the loss? So we definitely accept that argument that the accounting officer is not necessarily responsible for the loss, but I think where the confusion has come in is that the accounting officer is not here being held accountable for the loss. What the accounting officer is being held accountable for is not acting in terms of the law in order to recover that loss, to find out what the source of the loss is, who caused the loss, and whether the person can be held liable in law. So certainly it is a strict liability test. Rather, it's not a strict liability test because there is blame that's assigned now to the accounting officer, which blame is determined by the accounting officer's failure to act. So I think where the municipality got it wrong was to think that we would act against the accounting officer without giving the accounting officer an opportunity to remedy the situation. So certainly we are not saying the accounting officer is to blame for the loss. The accounting officer is rather to blame for not recovering the loss and following the financial prescripts that already exist. The PFMA and MFMA in particular provide steps to be taken when a loss occurred, and these include the manner in which the loss must be accounted for in the financial reporting process, the human resource actions to be taken, the reporting of criminal offences, and then lastly, debt recovery. So the role of the AG as we see it in terms of the amendment bill is a compliance management one, coupled with enforcement where an AO has renegated on their responsibilities. So as I explained, the aspect of blameworthiness then is not in relation to the cause, but rather the failure to recover. An AO acts in good faith and complies with the legislated legal prescripts will never find him or herself in the position of being held personally liable. All that's required is that they do exactly what the law is already saying they must do. They're not required to do anything further in terms of the amendment bill. Then number five, the definition of undesirable audit outcome. Many of the submissions raise an issue that the definition is problematic because it was not a known technical term and this may lead to interpretation problems. The AG is in agreement and has proposed a new definition. We've considered the proposed definition and agree that subject to regulations prescribing the test for materiality, the new definition is more legally sound. However, the definition caters for actions in addition to those that cause financial loss and also speaks to possible risks. Therefore, when using this definition in the context of the recovery, we will apply our minds in ensuring that the term only speaks to a material irregularity that has already occurred and which may have resulted in a financial loss. So that's just a technical drafting aspect that we need to apply our mind to. Discretionary audits. This one is something new that the committee hasn't considered fully to date. The Constitution, as some background, provides for two categories of audits, namely mandatory and discretionary. The mandatory ones are the ones that must be done in terms of the Constitution, and it includes the provincial government departments and the national government, and then also any entity where it's prescribed in law that that entity must be audited by the AG. Discretionary audits are exactly that. They are audits where the AG enjoys the discretion as to whether to conduct that audit or not. What the AG asked us to do was to build in criteria to assist the AG in applying his mind as to when to do a discretionary audit or not. And that was the purpose of the amendment that we built in initially. Dr. Naidu suggested that the audits of all public entities should be mandatory. And her argument, as we understood it, was that those entities would have to be audited in any case by an external auditor at a fee. And the AG is also responsible in that process for agreeing to the appointment of the external auditor as per Section 25. So the AG is already playing a role there, and a cost is already there's already a cost that the auditee at least must pay. Therefore, in her view, there's no adverse cost or resources implication if the AG now does it, because if the auditee can pay the fee to somebody else, then they may as well pay it to the AG. And since the AG is in any case involved in determining who the auditor must be, her view, as I understood it, was less than just simply make it mandatory for the AG's office to do all of that. The AG, however, does not support the recommendation due to the fact that, in their view, the economics of the office would not sustain such an obligation. The AG also further stated that the mandatory auditing of public entities will require an amendment to Section 1881 of the Constitution, as it's creating an additional category for mandatory audits. Chair, we respectfully disagree with this view and do not believe that a constitutional amendment would be necessary to provide for the mandatory auditing. Section 1881C already provides that it will be mandatory to audit any other institution or accounting entity required by national or provincial legislation to be audited. So if you simply had a piece of legislation that said public entities must be audited, then you would have, the AG would have to audit them. You wouldn't need the Constitution to be amended. And that was precisely the purpose of that catch-all section in the Constitution that left it to Parliament to decide which institutions must be audited in addition to the specific ones that are listed. However, this is a policy rather than a legal decision, and a simple amendment to the Public Audit Act to list these entities as mandatory will suffice. To argue otherwise would also mean that the listing of legislatures, which is something additional that's been listed in the PAA, municipal entities and constitutional institutions, would also then be unconstitutional by that same argument. It means provisions currently existing in the Act then are not constitutional because the AG has listed additional categories of mandatory institutions there that do not appear in the Constitution. So I don't think the argument is legally sound, but it is a policy decision for the committee to take. In the AG's response to Dr. Ramola's submission, it then stated that the purpose of the proposed amendment of Section 4.3 and 4 of the PAA was to give the AGA wider discretion to opt out of small mandatory audits, such as boards, trusts, and museums. So members may have come across examples of these legislations in the past. You may have a National Youth Commission Act that says the AG must audit the Youth Commission. And there's many smaller examples of, as they say, museums and other boards and so on. And their view was that these are becoming cumbersome, and as they said, the economics of their office don't necessarily support them doing these smaller audits. So their view was that the reworking of 4.3 and 4 as proposed in the amendment would allow the AG to opt out of those mandatory audits. That was not our understanding when drafting. Our understanding when drafting was that the purpose was merely to have criteria as to when a discretionary audit may be done. So in other words, you have three institutions where they may be audited, they don't have to be audited by the AG, but you have a parliamentary oversight committee saying to the AG, we want you to audit that institution because of some shenanigans that we believe is going on. Or you have the actual institution themselves approaching the AG and saying, please can you audit us, notwithstanding that there's nothing in law that compels you to audit us. And the AG was having difficulty in determining when to say yes and when to say no. When does it become fair and when does it become unfair? So the proposal was, let's build in certain criteria to assist the AG. What the AG has now said in response to Dr. Ramola, that the intention was, in fact, went further than that, was to also opt out of these mandatory audits, so these museums and so on. Our view is that this would be unconstitutional. The Constitution says Parliament has the right to determine who must be audited by the AG. So the AG certainly can't, of his own volition, decide that he is not going to audit, even if he applies applicable criteria, that he's not going to audit certain mandatory institutions. Notwithstanding the above, we take cognizance of the AG's dilemma, namely that Parliament simply passes or has passed legislation requiring the AG to audit the institution established in terms of that act without regard to their capacity, budgetary, and other constraints of the AG. So in respect of new legislation and in absence of a constitutional amendment to Section 1881C, we propose that a new amendment be crafted that provides at the least for a consultation process between the legislature and the AG when processing future bills that contain a mandatory obligation. Of course, the AG will never have the power to override Parliament, but at least if a committee intends inserting that provision in its bill that the AG must audit a particular institution to allow the AG an opportunity to advise why it won't be advisable, why it's practically not possible, or whatever the case may be, or perhaps to advise that criteria be built into the bill to determine when the AG will do it and when the AG can't do it. In terms of existing legislation requiring mandatory audits, we propose that the AG lobbies Parliament to pass a general laws amendment bill to amend all identified legislation to effect an amendment stipulating that the audit is no longer mandatory, but rather discretionary, and that such discretion will be exercised in accordance with applicable criteria. This will assist them now to resolve the problem of the existing smaller institutions that they are compelled to audit at present. But that falls outside of the scope of the current bill. If we were to include that in the current bill, it would mean identifying all those pieces of legislation right now. Then it would mean consulting with the relevant line committees who are the custodian of those pieces of legislation. It would mean additional public participation. And then lastly, it would mean further amendments in the actual actual bill itself in the form of a schedule where we would then list all that. So practically, we don't think it's advisable at present. In terms of international audits, based on my explanation of Section 1884 dealing with additional powers and functions, we are of the opinion that it would not be unconstitutional to permit the AG to conduct these audits, provided that the services do not detract from the primary obligations of the AG. we respectfully disagree with the public protector's view that it does not strengthen or support democracy. While the correlation may not be direct, it appears that these audits do carry with it staff development benefits in terms of skill and exposure, as well as opportunities for the AG to gain knowledge and experience in new auditing systems and emerging international best practice. These benefits then may serve to enhance the quality of local audits, as well as establish the AG as a reputable audit institution. Chair, the only proposal that we have on international audit is that we just apply our mind to the Kada Asmal report and, if necessary, build in additional provisions ensuring that there's no conflict of interest, that international audits are not done in a manner that will detract from the primary obligations. But I think everybody's in agreement that there's no constitutional issue there. Number eight, the recovery process. This was the heart and soul of the bill and where we received the majority of our submissions. As I said previously, we do not believe the issuing of the certificate itself and the recovery of the debt in itself is unconstitutional. But it is crucial that the procedure followed by the AG in fulfilling such a function does not invite constitutional and legal challenges. And in that respect, we're particularly looking at the encroachment argument that the AG's power must not be seen to be detracting from the power that an AO already enjoys. So it's in light of that that we then commented on the new proposed three-tiered level. Level one, according to the AG, and Chair, what I've done, you'll see that there's an annexure on the last page, or page 18 at least, that just summarizes the six steps that must be taken by the AG, so it might be useful to look at that whilst I talk. Level one is the issuing of the audit report with recommendations. This is just the normal step that the AG takes in any event. The AG issues an audit report as it's required to do in law, and that audit report contains recommendations. So we don't have any objection to level one. I have, however, suggested, and we will discuss it with the AG's office, whether we should perhaps include a reference there to the management letter. We've looked at other examples of international legislation. The management letter is dealt with. In our legislation, there's no reference to the management letter in terms of the steps that must be followed. And that may be useful because the purpose of the management letter legally is that it gives the accounting officer an opportunity to make representations on what's going to go into the audit report. So it does serve the purpose of an audit outcome part. So I did think it would be useful to add that. On level two, this happens 6 months after the AG has issued its report with recommendations. And here we support level two, namely the issuing of specific remedial action relating to the finding and recommendations as per the audit report. We are of the view that the 6 months lapse between level one and level two may be too long in certain circumstances, but we appreciate the AG's stance that this period is necessary to allow an accounting officer time and space to comply. Also, in determining the time frames, the AG has had to regard to their capacity and when they are physically able to go back into that institution to do a follow-up. So the time frame suits their current capacity constraints. However, we bring to the attention of the committee that the issuing of a certificate is linked specifically to the recovery of financial losses. As per the proposed definition of material irregularity, it's clear that the AG does not only report on unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless and wasteful expenditure, but also on non-compliance with legislation and breach of fiduciary duty that may not have resulted in a loss. So an example would be where the AG comes in and says, it's clear that you don't have sufficient HR policies, and our recommendation is that these particular policies are put into place. Now, those policies don't carry with it any financial, there's nothing financial about that. It's a simple task. Go and do an HR policy, because in the absence of that policy, we're having difficulty auditing your leave records and so on. We therefore recommend that the issuing of a certificate be one measure and additional thought be given as to how compliance and action can be ensured in respect of the other issues. Because you may have 10 recommendations, but only one of those recommendations speaks to the financial loss, which means that at the end of this process, no one is holding the AO to account to ensure that number 1 to number 9 is done. So if possible, perhaps we can think around whether the certificate must contain, or the remedial action must contain, some date by which certain things must be done, and the failure then to comply would mean that we refer it to Parliament to play its oversight role, or otherwise we simply ignore it and just focus on the financial losses. Level C is the actual referral for investigation and the issuing of the certificate. In short, we don't support the Level 3 proposal. According to the AG at this stage, which is now 6 months after the AG has issued the remedial action and 12 months after the AG issued the initial audit report, if no steps or inadequate steps have been taken to recover losses, the AG will refer the matter for investigation. Only once the outcome of the investigation is known will the AG proceed to issue a certificate. As I stated earlier, we are already concerned about the additional time frame of the 6 months between level 1 and 2. Now there's another 6 months between level 2 and 3. But not only that, what the AG is saying is at the end of level 3, if the accounting officer hasn't acted, the AG is not going to take further action in terms of issuing a certificate right then and there. What the AG then is going to do is to refer the matter to an appropriate body for investigation, which means our time frame after step 3 is an unknown. It's entirely dependent on how long it takes for that investigative body to report back. So this dependency waters down the effect of the remedial binding action, because the non-action is not dealt with, but rather the matter is sent for further investigation, the outcome of which is now unknown. In the Nkandla judgment, the court stated as follows: if compliance with remedial action taken were optional, then very few culprits, if any at all, would allow it to have any effect. And if it were by design never to have a binding effect, then it's incomprehensible just how the public protector could ever be effective in what she does and be able to contribute to the strengthening of our constitutional democracy. The referral to an investigative body as a step in determining whether to issue a certificate is also problematic for a number of other reasons. In law, none of the intended appropriate bodies are under any legal obligation to report to the AG, and to create such an obligation would possibly now require the amendment of the various pieces of legislation that govern these bodies. So exactly as I explained earlier about us then consulting with the line portfolio committees that are the custodian of those pieces of legislation, and most likely it will be justice, we would have to do the same here. We can certainly build in that the report must come either to SCOAG or to Parliament, because Parliament already, in terms of the Constitution, enjoys an oversight role. So there's no problem with that. In our view, the referral should not be linked to the issuing of the certificate, but should rather be a standalone provision empowering the AG at any stage of the auditing process to refer a matter for investigation. We had some discussion in the last committee meeting that there certainly are instances when the AG, even before issuing its report, even at the time when it's drafting its management letter, it's clear that certain corruption or certain untoward criminal activities are occurring. And if you build in the power for referral in terms of stage 3, then it means that the AG won't report those instances prior to reaching that 12-month period, by which point more plundering of resources may have occurred. Also then, Chair, not every unauthorized, irregular, and fruitful and wasteful transaction is necessarily criminal in terms of what the Hawks and the SIU would investigate. It may be a financial criminality in terms of the PFMA because it's a financial misconduct, but it may not then be something that the Hawks would want to investigate, and they would simply say, we're not prepared to investigate this matter or this matter falls outside of our mandate. That means that your entire process then falls flat at stage three. So our proposal is that at stage three, what the AG should then do at that point, rather than referring to another body, thereby making his own remedial action questionable, because he's throwing into question what he said in stage two, which is that I have identified that this irregularity occurred. I have identified the steps that must be taken in order for you to fix the irregularity. But now, notwithstanding same, I'm going to ask another body to confirm that my finding of the irregularity indeed is irregular, which in law leads us to another important problem, which the AG already sits with, is that the audit report is already being challenged. Our view is that the audit report, and it's a view shared by the AG, is that the audit report is indeed binding. It's a binding finding. The recommendations currently are not binding. But to now throw it to an investigative body to confirm what was initially in your report as an irregular expenditure detracts from the enforceability of the report, and it detracts from the finding, which in our view it must be a sound finding, because otherwise you're saying that the AG is merely of the view that it's an irregularity. So you're going to then find that other bodies are going to use the step three as a defense where they don't comply initially with the audit report, where they take the audit report and a review, and they'll say, but the AG, by his own design in his recovery process, is saying my audit report is not reliable insofar as I have to refer it to another investigative body. So I'm very concerned about the legal nuances there. However, I understand the AG's dilemma here, which is that the AG doesn't want to be in a position where he's issuing a certificate without sufficient information and evidence before him, because the chances are then quite high that that's going to be challenged in a review process. Therefore, my proposal is that we build in something that says the AG, when considering whether to issue a certificate, must apply his mind to various things. One could be the outcome or report of a forensic investigation conducted in terms of the existing Section 29. So Section 29 of the Public Audit Act says that the AG may use a forensic investigator to do an investigation on the AG's behalf or to conduct that investigation. So already at stage one, there's nothing, or prior even to stage one, there's nothing that prevents the AG from conducting that investigation simultaneously. The law allows for it. Then hopefully by the time the 12-month period has elapsed, the AG then has some sort of a report from that investigation process. Then the outcome or progress report in respect of a referral. So if you refer early on, you may at least have some progress. What often happens is you would, for example, have the Hawks come to Scopa and say, we're not ready to proceed to refer this to the National Director of Public Prosecution for charging the person, but there's sufficient evidence to now freeze certain assets, or we've identified two of the culprits, but there's a ring of corruption that's happening here, and we're trying to get all our ducks in a row before we conclude the process. That would be then sufficient information for the AG then to act at that point. Lastly, then, for the AG to simply consider the report of the accounting officer in terms of the steps taken to follow up on the loss and the recommendations in the remedial action report. Because if we start from the premise that what's in the report is correct, that the transaction indeed is irregular, then the accounting officer must act. We cannot have a situation where accounting officers then say, we're also waiting for the outcome of the Hawks investigation or SIU investigation or Competition Commission investigation, whatever it may be, before we take steps. So in this way, the AG can act in the absence of a report, if he so wishes, based purely on the fact that despite his audit finding reflecting that irregularities, nothing has been done to determine the cause of the loss and to hold anyone responsible in law. Then also linked to this was the issue of an appeal. It was felt that there should be an appeal mechanism built into the bill to provide that where the AG makes a decision to issue the certificate, that that decision can be reviewed by another body before going to court. Chair, I'm fairly confident that this would be unconstitutional because I cannot see how another body can overturn the decision of the AG. I've considered it carefully and I understand what the mischief is here. You don't want to waste time and the resources going to court. So what I propose is that we consider a two-tiered audi auctum partum process rather than an appeal process. The way this would work is that step one, the AG would issue a notice of his intention to issue the certificate to the AO and then provide the AO with a opportunity to make representations within the prescribed period. That's already built in. Then when considering these written representations, if the AG's intent does not change, so he's not persuaded by the written representations, the AG can then invite the accounting officer to make oral representations to an advisory committee established in terms of Section 5.2b of the Act. So the Act already empowers the AG to have these advisory committees set up, so the AG would simply need to set up a committee for this purpose, and that committee consists of technical experts. So the accounting officer now has an opportunity to lay his case in front of this technical team, which would obviously include legal people, it would include audit people, possibly somebody from National Treasury, and so on. The logistics of that can be worked out. And then after considering the views of the Special Advisory Committee, the AG can then make his final decision whether to issue the certificate or not. This will assist in a review process because if the matter is taken on review, the AG can show that in applying my mind, I considered what this panel of experts had to say, and if he disagreed with the panel of experts, it would mean that his threshold of convincing the court as to why he still issued the certificate would then be higher, and that would be a level of protection for the AO. So this is very similar to those of you who understand procurement processes. It's very similar to currently what happens where your accounting officer is the person in law who awards a bid. But notwithstanding that, we still have a process of a bid evaluation committee that crunches the numbers and then a bid adjudication committee who makes a recommendation to the accounting officer. The accounting officer can always reject that recommendation, but he must have very sound reasons for doing so. So an example would be we wanted to give a tender to Steinhoff. The bid adjudication committee says Steinhoff is the preferred tenderer for a furniture contract, but by the time it comes to the accounting officer, the Steinhoff debacle has broken loose and it's clear Steinhoff is in financial trouble, and the accounting officer then says, well, notwithstanding that recommendation, I've got sound reasons not to follow the recommendation. And similarly, the AG will have to have sound reasons for not following the recommendation of the independent advisory committee. On the issue of who will actually recover the debt, there's general consensus that the function should not be given to the AG. The question for determination, therefore, is if not the AG, then who must do it? A proposal was received that the AG should make use of pro bono services of private attorneys to conduct on its behalf. So I just thought it necessary for me to explain this concept of pro bono. It comes from the Latin term pro bono publico, meaning for the public good, and it describes legal work undertaken without payment for clients who would otherwise be unable to access legal services. Section 34 of our Constitution provides that every person has the right to have a dispute resolved by the application of law decided in a fair public hearing before a court. However, the reality, of course, is that for the majority of South Africans, access to legal services is not easy because of the cost involved. Precisely for this reason, the various law societies that govern the legal profession in the different provinces provide rules that determine that each practicing attorney must commit to a certain number of hours per month or per year of pro bono work. It's hard for me to rationalize why these pro bono hours that should be used for the benefit of the public on the ground should now be used to assist the state, where state officials and functionaries have not done what they are supposed to do in law. It just doesn't make any logical sense, because you're going to rob the very people who need it most desperately. And I don't think it's fair to say that the state doesn't have its own resources to tackle legal matters, especially where it's the cause of those legal matters itself. Also, practically, this arrangement is going to be extremely difficult to manage, because it means that the AG will be the instructing client, and the AG will have to liaise now with a multitude of private attorneys. And then, of course, what happens when the private attorney doesn't do its job? You would then need to report to the Law Society, and it just becomes very complex. But more importantly, I believe it's going to require an amendment to the Legal Practice Act, because we would need to be specific in that act, so that where a professional body is, where a law society is stipulating rules relating to pro bono, it would have to make provision for this particular purpose. That doesn't exist in law. The second option was to refer the duty of recovery to the national or provincial treasury. And this option appears to be a natural extension of the Treasury oversight role in the respect of fiscal management. However, there are also practical stumbling blocks. This new responsibility has not been costed, and it's not clear to what extent it will require additional capacity and resources within the Treasury. Furthermore, some auditees partly generate their own revenue, which will require an additional step after recovery, namely the transfer of recovered funds back to the relevant entity, because in law, that money resides with them and not with Treasury. So in the example of national departments, where a national department recovers money, it must pay that money to national treasury. That's what the law currently provides. But where a municipality collects money, the municipality keeps that money in its primary bank account. The third and preferred option is for the executive authority to collect the debt in terms of an entity's own debt recovery policy. In the case of national and provincial departments and public entities, this will be the relevant line minister or the MEC, as the case may be. For municipalities, it will be the municipal council. Monies recovered by national and provincial departments will thereafter need to be transferred into the relevant revenue fund as per Section 13 of the PFMA. The reason why practically this option also makes sense is that one of the big issues that we battled with when drafting was when you determine that the debt is owed and you issue the certificate, how do you reach payment arrangements with the person now owing the money? Not everybody is going, in most likelihood, the person's not going to be able to pay once off. So you would need to negotiate how payment is going to be made, when payment is going to be made, if it's going to be taken off the salary of the official, that would need to be in terms of the HR policies. You may need a garnishee order, et cetera, et cetera. So it makes more legal sense to say to the executive authority, go and do this, but do it in terms of your existing policies that you have in any case. And, Chair, this proposal seems to be supported by Kada Asmal's report on Chapter 9 institutions. In that report, it's noted that the practical implementation of any recommendations emanating from an audit is best achieved with the active participation of the executive. Also, this allows us then, as Parliament, to hold the executive to account, to call them in and ask why they haven't taken action on a certificate that's been issued. Then on audit fees, this is a matter that as early as this morning we received a proposal from National Treasury. It is a policy issue, but I just wanted the committee to apply its mind to the one legal aspect here. Just to explain so that members understand when you are considering the issue of fees, Section 26 of the Act as it currently stands provides that if the audit fee exceeds 1% of the total current and capital expenditure of the auditee, and in the opinion of National Treasury, that auditee has financial difficulty to settle the fees, then the National Treasury must defray the cost in excess of the 1%. This obligation doesn't apply to national and provincial departments. They are liable for their audit fees in full. So a practical example, just to assist the committee, that follows. A municipality incurs an audit fee of 120,000. Its total current and capital expenditure is 10 million, with the result now that the audit fee is in excess of that 1% by 20,000 rand. So if the audit fee was simply 100,000 rand, the municipality would have to pay it itself. But because it's 120,000 rand, National Treasury must, if it's in the view that of the view that that auditee has financial difficulty, defray that additional 20,000 rand to satisfy the AG's account. So National Treasury proposed that the provision be redrafted to reflect that it would only pay such excess amount or percentage as it would agree with the AG annually. So in the example above, it would mean that in the absence of an agreement between the parties in a particular financial year, National Treasury will pay nothing. If there is agreement and the agreement is not in respect of 100% of the 20,000, then it means that the AG would have to then try to recover that money from that auditee who is already in financial difficulty. So you're making it extremely practically problematic for the AG. So whilst we appreciate the difficulty that National Treasury faces in the current challenging fiscal climate, which does favour an austerity approach, we are presented now with a legal dilemma, which is that the AG is constitutionally mandated to conduct these mandatory audits. So the AG doesn't have a choice here to say, well, municipality, I'm not going to audit you because I know that you can't pay my fees. The AG has no choice in the matter. So certainly when the constitution was designed, that is an issue that had to have been considered. This leads to a situation now where the resources of the AG will be stretched, the quality of audits may be compromised, and the AG in pursuing the payment of fees might be detracted from its core business of having to focus on debt recovery. And that takes us to the debt recovery argument in respect of the certificate. This is exactly what people were raising. The AG shouldn't be bogged down with these issues. There is no legal barrier that currently prevents the AG from requesting an appropriation from Parliament. Section 36(1)(b) of the Public Audit Act already specifically provides that the AG may request an appropriation. Now, I know there's been talk that the AG is independent and the AG doesn't want to request an appropriation, but all of the other Chapter 9 institutions are also independent, but yet they are all entirely funded from government. The AG, in fact, is unique in that the AG is the only self-sufficient Chapter 9 institution. So nothing in law prevents the AG from asking for an appropriation. The question of how the excess fees must be paid and by whom is therefore a policy issue that must be considered, however, in light of the AG's legal obligation to audit. And if a role for National Treasury is retained, the clause must be clear and provide for consequences where an agreement cannot be reached. In its current form, it's merely in law what we call an agreement to agree, which is not, in fact, legally enforceable. And then you're going to be led with a bizarre situation where the parties simply refuse to speak to each other and the AG then sits with a problem. The next issue, number 12, this was on the GAAP and GRAP reporting framework. Comments were received challenging the fact that the AG is non-compliant with the PFMA insofar as it does not apply the generally recognized accounting practice issued by the Accounting Standards Board in its own financial reporting. This is a standard that's applied generally by the rest of government. The AG, unlike other Chapter 9 institutions, is not subject to the PFMA, so that's quite an interesting fact that it's not listed in Schedule 1 of the PFMA. We don't know what the intention of the drafters was there, but it might be because of the peculiar nature of the AG's office and the type of work that they do, that it was specifically not included. But in the absence of it being included in Schedule 1, it means that the assertion that they are non-compliant with the PFMA is not true because they're not subject to the PFMA. Section 41(2) of the PAA currently provides that the financial statements of the AG must be in accordance with South African GAAP or other international best practice approved by the oversight mechanism. SA GAAP has, however, been withdrawn for financial years commencing December 2012. So this does necessitate an amendment of the Act. We need to to remove that. The issue, however, for which financial reporting framework the AG should utilize is a policy issue. We are, however, comfortable that the approval mechanism contained in Section 41.2, which requires this committee to approve the framework, prevents any risk that the AG uses a reporting framework that is not reliable or accurate, because in determining which framework they have to use, they first need to come to the committee. In this regard, and this is just a separate issue from the bill now, but I urge the committee, when considering the Section 41.2 permission in future, to apply its mind to auditing practice statements issued by professional bodies such as the Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors in reaching this decision on what an acceptable framework is. So I have cited an example there in footnote 9, and members can go and read that in future when the AG comes to ask. It's quite a helpful document in determining what is an acceptable framework. However, the committee still requested now to consider whether 41.2 should be amended to replace SA-GAAP with GRAP, or whether to simply delete the option of SA-GAAP and then just leave it open to, say, any international best practice framework may be used. Then, in terms of regulations, accountability nowadays, a concern that the bill empowers the AG to make regulations, and the assertion is that this would result in a conflict of interest. There's no basis in law that prevents the AG from making regulations. It's in fact extremely common that the passing of regulations, which is a form of subordinate legislation, is delegated to an executive authority or other suitable body like a rules board. In the case of the AG, however, the AG is unique in that there is no executive authority that oversees the powers and functions of the AG. So there isn't a line function minister that's responsible for the AG. The AG simply reports to Parliament, who has an oversight role. In the Constitutional Court case of New Clicks, Judge Chaskelson did say that the making of delegated legislation by a member of the executive is an essential part of public administration in that it gives effect to legislative policies. The view being that these functionaries are the subject matter experts and are therefore best placed to make regulations. We satisfy that currently there are sufficient checks and balances on the AG's power to issue regulations, because it includes a requirement for consultation with the oversight mechanism prior to issuing those regulations. If the committee wants, we can build in additional safeguards, such as a compulsory public participation process in the form of a duty on the AG to publish draft regulations for comment prior to issuing SAM. Then, Chair, there's a number of technical drafting issues which I don't know if you want us to take you through. I can maybe just highlight them quickly. Dr. Naidu very usefully pointed out to us that in other sections of the Act, reference is made to legislation that has since been repealed. It wasn't the subject matter of the amendments that we made, but nonetheless, this is a useful opportunity for us to do that cleaning up exercise. So we have already been in touch with the AG's office to take this on board. There are no legal implications, simply cleaning up. We have an issue with the commencement date of the bill, and this is because the Determination of Remuneration of Office Bearers Act, which deals with the salary of the AG, that is not signed into law yet. Yet in our Act, we're making a reference to that Act. So it can be fixed by simply providing that when that Act comes into operation, that's when our section will come into operation. But if that Act comes into operation prior to our Act coming into operation, then it's fine. Then you don't have any issue. But that's beyond our control for now. We have made contact with a relevant committee that's dealing with this, and they weren't able to give us any firm indication as to when this is going to be signed into law. Then we just need to ensure that words defined in the bill carry the correct meaning throughout the principal act. And this is quite technical terms like prescribed. We just need to make sure that because we inserted a definition of prescriber, that definition can carry through and make sense everywhere else where prescribed is used. There is a section in the Act where we believe it shouldn't be prescribed, it should be set out. We've discussed that with the AG's office and we're working on those, but there's no legal implications there. In terms of the way forward, what we need guidance from the committee on is firstly whether former accounting officers are to be included to the extent that they fail to act during the recovery process, so during the three-tiered approach. In other words, an AO that resigns after the six-month period following the issuing of the remedial action will still be held liable for payment. So the committee just needs to give us guidance there whether you want to include those people or not include them. We don't think it's retrospective, so that isn't an issue. Then, B, whether the issue of mandatory audits in future legislation be managed by inserting a provision in the bill requiring consultation with the AG. This consultation may either be between SCOAG or the relevant line committee processing the bill and the AG. So just some thought needs to be put into where that's best placed. C, whether the recovery process proposed by the AG be adopted in the proposed form, so as it appears in my annexure, or whether level 3 be recrafted so as not to create a dependency between the outcome of an investigation and the issuing of a certificate. So if the committee is in agreement with our proposal, we will build the power of investigation as a separate standalone, and then in terms of level 3, the AG will have to act on level 3 the moment it now becomes clear that the accounting officer hasn't done anything. But in applying his mind, he may apply his mind to the outcome of a referral that he would have done earlier on in the process. Then, whether the term appropriate bodies in relation to the referral function must be listed specifically. So do we specifically want to say it's the Hawks, it's the SIU, it's the Competition Commission, or should we leave it open? And here we also need to think about if we're going to list specifically whether we would need to change the existing legislation governing those entities in terms of the reporting obligation. Then whether the debt collection function be transferred to the National Treasury or alternatively to the relevant executive authority. I'm assuming that the committee will not go with a pro bono option for the various reasons that I offered earlier. And then whether the audit outcome partum process be redesigned to include that additional level of consultation at the level of the advisory committee on the basis that we don't agree an appeal is constitutionally sound. And then whether the provision on audit fees must be amended, and if so, how. And that is it from our side. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Honourable Dubas. And it might be a bit difficult for you to follow because we've been doing this for about 2 weeks in your way, but I think it was very helpful for the rest of us that were here. Thank you so much, ma'am. Baba, you want to add to? Yes, sir?
Chair, may I have about 10 minutes or 5 minutes break for us to take our tea? And then, Chair, you know, I'm quite serious about this. You know, I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I'm diabetic. I don't eat anything at home. Right? The meeting starts at 9:30. By the time you get a bus or get into traffic, it takes you an hour and a half. It took me an hour 45 minutes. So I think we really either start half past nine or we do something about it. At the moment I'm feeling sick and I can't concentrate. So really it's taken over.
All right. I assume that's a 10-minute break. It's fine? Fine. We will come back. I suppose we're not going out, but I'm saying we will resume at 20 past. Got it? 20 past.
Sure.
Welcome to the intelligence.